There's rarely an incident that's going to occur in your airplane that's truly life-threatening. That if you don't take care of it, like within 1 or 2 seconds, you're going to die. That's very rare. And yes, there are those times that that's going to happen. But the main thing is just to take a breath
Right.
and say, okay, wait, all right, we've got a problem. And so that's my coping mechanism is just to, okay, I don't have to make an immediate decision. We're not facing nose down in a spiral heading straight down to the ground. So it's just take a breath.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. My guest today is Alan Cruz, pilot and adventurer. I met Alan while I was on assignment in Denver, and he and his team from NASA were also on assignment in Denver, separate assignments, of course. And we met as people who are on assignments far away from home are apt to meet in the hotel bar. And as we were speaking and they started sharing with me what their program was at NASA, which was SOFIA, I became completely infatuated. When I was younger, I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be an astronaut. And I was fascinated with NASA. This is the Apollo program, the Skylab program. And so we all got along wonderfully. And as the night went on, they asked me if I wanted to join them to, the next day for simulator training in a classic 747. And of course, I said yes. Alan's story is a great one, earning his pilot's license before most people earn their driver's license. From then, his life was one confluence of circumstances and events after another until he got his chance to fly missions for NASA as a pilot in the SOFIA program, a fascinating program that was recently terminated. Welcome, Alan. Great to have you on the show today. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Joe. Good to see you again.
It's been a few months, and I got to tell you, Alan, I've shared the story of our meeting countless times. You guys there at NASA and the SOFIA project, made my dream come true. As I shared with you, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a pilot. Okay, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I wanted to be. I was fascinated with NASA. My father worked for IBM Federal Systems Division, and I would write to the NASA or the Apollo program, then the Skylab program, and I would get all sorts of EVA pictures and pamphlets and patches and everything else. So, when you guys, when I met you guys in Denver, and you started sharing about your program, and I was like fascinated. And then Carrie went up and got a sticker for your program, the SOFIA project, which, by the way, I hadn't ever heard of, and I thought it was fascinating. But then you guys asked me to go over to the sim with you, and it was like, are you kidding me? I immediately sent my client an email saying I'm going to be late, and I went over with you guys, and guess what? The simulator that you used was actually built in my hometown of Binghamton, a Lynx simulation.
Oh, neat.
So okay. Like all the connections were there. And,
okay.
And so, yeah. So you're a great teacher. Okay. I mean, I was sitting in the main chair there. You're in the second chair, and the way you explained everything, your patience of Job with me having never sat there. But I got to tell you one thing, I got to confess, because you asked me a couple of times to look out the window, and I've taken countless flights and I've looked out the window before. What I haven't done before was look at all the gauges. Okay. Yeah. The artificial horizon and, the speed and like everything. So that had me completely captivated because of all the goings on. So I appreciated what's going on outside the window, but I was really fascinated with the dash. And
that's
so anyway,
neat. Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
So how did you get to be a pilot?
I think all of the credit has to go to my dad. My dad worked at Lockheed Marietta and was, for as long of a time that I knew my dad, was in charge of the C-130 program at Lockheed. he was a private pilot. And I still have the picture of me sitting on top of four phone books in the right seat of a little Cessna with my dad on my very first flight that my dad took me on. And
how'd you reach the pedals?
I couldn't, actually. My dad let me do the control yoke, but I couldn't even reach the pedals. But my mom was out there, and she took a picture of me with this huge smile on my face as we came back and you know, to the ramp to park the airplane. That was my first flight, and I think I was smitten ever since. And quick story is my dad was my flight instructor. So
your dad was your flight instructor.
He went through all the steps to become a certified flight instructor so that he could, I think the only reason he did it was so that he could get me through my private pilot's license when I got old enough.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he did a little bit of instruction for other students, but I was his main student. And I think as I look back on it, that was just the love that my dad had for me because he wanted to make sure that I was going to be a safe pilot. So he was hard on me.
Sure. I was going to say, was he, you were very patient with me. Of course, we couldn't crash anything because, you know, we're in the sim, but you seemed to be a very empathetic teacher. And you're saying your father was probably a little bit less forgiving?
No, he was very forgiving, a very good teacher. But I think my dad is where I got what little patience I may have. It's probably that's where I got it all from. but you know, honestly, I just enjoy the teaching part of it. And, you know, I've been in even aviation teaching scenarios where I was the student and the teacher was trying to prove what he knew and what I didn't know. And I always felt, regardless of whether it's aviation or whether it's something else, that's not a good teaching scenario. You always want to awaken somebody's mind when you're trying to teach them something, not try to slap them on the back or hit them on the head and say, this is what you don't know, and this is the way you have to do it. You want to give everybody the opportunity to learn however they best learn. And I've carried that through to even the teaching, you know, in the aviation industry, because that's just something that you learn. I mean, it's, you know, with, you know, my aviation career, which we can go over whenever, you know, you're ready, but a lot of being a captain on an airplane is you have to be in a flight instructor position, because a lot of people that you'll get in the right seat, they're brand new and they're scared to death. And so you have to put them at ease so that they are comfortable flying the airplane. But the majority of your job as a captain is teaching the guy in the right seat how to fly the airplane that you're flying. Mm-hmm. So it's been a 24/7 teaching position for most of my aviation career.
So. I watch in Germany, they call it the show Mayday. I don't know what they call it in the States, but it's always a deconstruction of airline incidents. Airplane incidents. Okay. And there's oftentimes a dominant or a domineering pilot that doesn't listen to the co-pilot on occasion, or thinks they know better, and they get this tunnel vision. You know, I could see that being a real challenge if you have a salty, experienced captain that just refuses to listen. You obviously you're not that individual. I can't imagine you being that individual, but I could see this, the challenge being a two-way communication. You know, the captain, you know, they're of course trying to instruct the co-pilot, the younger or less experienced pilot. But, you know, how do they not insulate themselves so that they become boxed in to their own world? I mean, do you have any coping mechanisms, or is it just a personality trait?
I think it's probably both. There's a little bit of a personality trait. And again, I've been like with Evergreen for 17 years, with a commuter airline for 13 years prior to that. And so I've seen a lot of different personalities. And there are those that you just sit there and you go, you know, I could talk to this guy all day long. He's never going to listen to his crew. And those are the types, you know, that you have to do your best to educate them. But as far as like for me, the coping mechanism, you know, aviation is a little bit different than like, you know, sitting behind a desk or working in a manufacturing plant, because even teaching in aviation, one thing a flight instructor has to understand is that his student is in what that student perceives as a life-threatening situation. Right. When you're sitting up there doing maneuvers or pulling engines out, even in the commercial business, you know, used to with, you know, when I was with Atlantic Southeast Airlines, we didn't have simulators. We were all out the middle of the night training in an airplane that was overnighting, and we were actually pulling engines and actually having emergencies, you know, in the airplane, simulated in the airplane, of course. But, you know, that's a life-threatening situation to a lot of people. Right. And so you have to take that into account. And then for the coping part of it, you know, it's just a matter that sometimes, you know, there's rarely, and I guess for me, I always had to look at it. There's rarely an incident that's going to occur in your airplane that's truly life-threatening. That if you don't take care of it, like within 1 or 2 seconds, you're going to die. That's very rare. And yes, there are those times that that's going to happen. But the main thing is just to take a breath.
Right.
And say, okay, wait, you know, all right, we've got a problem. And so that's my coping mechanism is just to, okay, I don't have to make an immediate decision. We're not, you know, we're not facing nose down in a spiral heading straight down to the ground. So it's just take a breath. And then for me, fortunately, like with the Evergreen, which is where I flew with before, they're the classic 747, like Sophia was, like the simulator you flew. So not only do I have a co-pilot that I can get suggestions from, I have a flight engineer back there too.
Right.
And you always want to try to, again, once you're in the, you know, the captain's job is actually flying is all subconscious. Your job is managing the airplane and managing your crew, because you're going to have three different personalities in the cockpit. Most of the times they're great, you know, but every now and then, yeah, you're going to have that person that makes things difficult, but you do have to listen. And you have to listen to your crew and you have to accept what you have as your crew. You know, for instance, you know, hopping on board a 747 and I've got a flight engineer that this is his first flight out of training. And I've got a co-pilot that he's on his third flight from IOE. So you have to take into account that, okay, well, now I've got brand new people, but they still can contribute to whatever might be going on, because they're still accomplished pilots. So if there's a weather issue, oh, sure, I'm going to, you know, we're going to always talk about everything that's going on. But if there is a, you know, the education part comes in, okay, well, yeah, we're fixing to go land in Kabul, Afghanistan. And yes, we're going down in between mountains. And no, we can't make a left or right turn going down the approach, because you'll hit a mountain before you can even level out of your turn. So things like that, you have to teach them, because they're still trying to figure out what the airplane is doing, right, and have forgotten about the situational awareness. So you always have to bear in mind, where is this guy that I'm working with? You know, where is he? Is he actually in that seat where the airplane is, or is he still back there putting the gear handle up, trying to figure out where we are?
So when did you get your license, your pilot's license? How old were you?
I got it on my 17th birthday, which wow. is you have to be 17 years old to get a private pilot's license here. So my 17th birthday, which it started to get complicated because my birthday is just before Christmas. So all the federal, you know, examiners were just about ready to take Christmas break. So I had that one day to get it done and got it done, you know, with my dad standing out there as I came back. So,
right. So 17 years old, your passion for flying is obvious, unmistakable. What did you do after you got your pilot's license and out of high school? What was next?
Well, after I got the pilot's license, the main thing was taking, you know, my buddies up in high school. You know, they were like, oh, yeah, right. You're going to go take us for an airplane ride. You know, we heard you were getting an instruction. And then the next thing you know, everybody's in the high school, you know, showing pictures. Look, Alan can fly an airplane by himself. So that was the fun ego thing, was to take friends up. We just go rent an airplane and go fly. And then after high school, which was, you know, basically graduated a year after I got my pilot's license, my right. goal was to be an astronaut. That was my deal.
I'm with
so,
you.
So I actually made the move. I actually contacted NASA at Cape Canaveral. I went down to a college in Central Florida just so I could be within a 45-minute, one-hour drive of NASA. And started going to college, and literally every weekend I would blast off in my old Volkswagen van and run over to Cape Canaveral and meet with people. I actually got a little badge at Cape Canaveral so I could actually just drive around wherever I wanted to at Cape Canaveral, and got myself into trouble a couple of times. But, they saw the badge and it's like, oh, okay, well, I guess, yeah, we'll show you around. So I got to meet a lot of people and started somewhat co-oping with NASA while I was in college. As things progressed, they were like, okay, well, let's just run you through certain tests that we would put astronauts through. And this was back, grant you, in 1980. So the shuttle was just starting to come into existence.
Okay.
Anyway, they found out that I had a high frequency nerve deafness. So I had a high frequency hearing loss, which today I don't think that matters very much, but back then there was no exceptions for any medical quote unquote deficiency. And I had right. a medical deficiency. So I was told that I would not be able to be an astronaut. So that, of course, put a kink in my plans. But that's where I think you have to remember that there's certain things thrown in your life's path that are put there for a reason. As an 18-year-old kid, that was real difficult to accept.
But, yeah.
So I just basically said, okay, well, now what do I do? Well, there's no reason to spend my mom and dad's money going to an out-of-state college, because that literally triples the tuition if you're not going to the same right. state. So I came back to Georgia, and I just decided, well, I'm going to get a job to support myself, and I'm going to try to get all the hours that I can and start building up my pilot's license and see what I need to do to become a professional pilot. So it's a lot of it I have to give to divine intervention, but I mean, there were a lot of things. My neighbor owned a construction company, and he was the one that put me to work when I came back from college. Well, they had a small twin engine airplane. And of course I latched onto their corporate pilot, like a dog on a leash. And the owner of the company allowed me to go sit in the right seat of his airplane whenever I wasn't working or on the weekends when they were taking trips. So I got to go sit in the right seat of their airplane. And that particular
pilot, plane was it?
It was a Piper Navajo.
Okay.
Which to me might as well have been a 747. 18-year-old kid, never flown anything except a Cessna. That was a huge, big airplane.
Yeah.
So that corporate pilot then became my commercial instrument multi-engine instructor. So a lot of the instruction was done in that airplane. I was actually able to log some time in that airplane when he was ferrying the airplane. There was nobody in it. He actually, okay, well, we're just going to do a flight back and we'll call it multi-engine instruction.
Okay. So when you're in Florida, what degree did you get from the university there?
I never finished my degree.
You never finished your degree, and till today, you still don't have a degree?
I still don't have a degree. I was going for an aeronautical engineering degree, mainly because I was thinking I was going to go be an astronaut. So I started all the preliminary stuff for the aeronautical engineering degree. So that was fun. That was neat, because I kind of saw myself. My dad always had these engineering books that he brought home, and he was doing the old drafting table type work at Lockheed. And so I was seeing some of that stuff, but when I never did finish my degree. I came back and went to college at a community college in Atlanta just for a little bit. But then a job opportunity came up with the contractor that I was working with. And again, it was to be a nuclear coatings inspector, and it paid good money. And it was like, okay, but you've got to go to the school, to become this nuclear coatings inspector, which sounds all fancy, but basically all I'm doing is going down inside the torus of a nuclear reactor as it's under maintenance and checking painting quality. It's not as fancy of a job as it sounds, but it paid good. And I got to go into a nuclear reactor facility. So I was just, just all pumped. So I quit college. And then after that job, went away, I got my flight instructors. certificate, started building my hours, and then had a couple of little jobs in between. And then, like I say, divine intervention, this corporate pilot that was the, you know, for the contracting company I work for, called me up one day and said, "Hey, I'm flying for this company called Atlantic Southeast Airlines." They were a commuter airline before anybody knew what a commuter airline was. Okay. Nobody knew anybody except Delta and United and American. They didn't know of these people that were operating these little 12 passenger turboprop airplanes to the little cities. And Atlantic Southeast Airlines, basically, I think they had like 40 pilots at the time. It was small. And he asked if I wanted to come fly. And so I literally told him, "I don't have enough hours. You got to be kidding me. I only had maybe, you know, 600 or 700 hours of total time."
Total time. This is including when you were 17 years old and learning.
Yes, so, exactly. So okay. Not very much time.
Right.
So he said, "Well, no, come down and talk to him." And I went down and I talked to the chief pilots. And next thing I know, they said, "Well, you know, I did not even have my multi-engine commercial rating yet. That's how far, you know, that's where I was in my pilot career." And they literally said, "Well, if you can," you know, this was on a Tuesday, and they said, "If you can get your multi-engine, you know, commercial rating by Monday, we'll put you in ground school." So that's okay, how desperate they were for pilots.
Okay. So did you get your rating in a compressed amount of time?
I already had all the time. I had everything that I needed. I just hadn't actually taken the check ride.
Ah, okay.
So, and again, that was a money thing. Commercial multi-engine airplanes are expensive to rent.
Right.
So I think I actually went to my mom and dad and said, "Can I borrow some money so that I can go rent this multi-engine airplane? I think I can get this job flying." And they loaned me the money. I went out with an instructor. He gave me a mock check ride. And then the next day, I went out with the federal examiner, and I had the little piece of paper that said I had all the ratings I needed to go to work for Atlantic Southeast Airlines. And sure enough, that Monday morning, I was in ground school.
Awesome.
And so, you know, long story short, the next thing I know is that I'm flying this little turboprop, twin engine turboprop airplane. And here I am, never even cranked up a turboprop before. And so, again, I'm just moving up in this airplane, you know. And anyway, the next thing I know, I'm flying passengers around in the right seat of a turboprop airplane. And then literally 3 months after I'd been with ASA, they said, "Hey, there's an opening on this Dash 7, which is a big four engine turboprop airplane." Okay. Huge. So the next thing I know, I'm sitting there looking out the right window at these two engines on just on one wing. So I was like a kid in a candy store flying this big old four engine airplane around. And then the next thing that happened was, I mean, within the year, I actually had to wait to upgrade to captain until I turned 23. So
now you're multi-engine rated at 23 in the captain seat.
In the captain seat, yeah. And there's a rule under the federal aviation regulations for what that airline was operating under that a captain had to be at least 23 years old. So I could have actually upgraded to captain earlier, but I had to wait till my 23rd birthday to get into the left seat. So then here I was flying around this little twin engine turboprop in the left seat back to the same airplane I started in. And then 6 months later, I was flying in this brand new, nice 30 passenger, you know, it's called an EMB-120 Brasilia airplane, which had all the glass up front. And all of a sudden I find myself in the left seat of this airplane going through a group of people. That's the first people ever certified on this aircraft type in the US. And next thing I know, we're all through training and I'm sitting there in Atlanta on the ramp, taking people on board this airplane, actually looking down at them from my left-hand window as they board an air stair door, which I'd never had before either, except on the Dash 7. So, you know, I still remember one of the gate agents coming out to me to bring us the paperwork. And she said, "Alan, almost," you know, we had a lady come back. I said, "She's on here now," but she came back and she actually walked back to the gate. And she wasn't going to get on the airplane. I said, "What was wrong?" She said, she said, "There's a little boy in the cockpit." So I'm just, you know, that's kind of when it hit me that how fortunate all my life turns had been. So, but I stayed with Atlantic Southeast for 13 years And then, you know, if you want to hear the story, I'll tell you how I got on with Evergreen. And then that led up to NASA. So,
yeah, please. And don't, yeah. You can't leave any gaps. Holy cow.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so for 13 years, I flew with Atlantic Southeast Airlines, nice airline to work for, had a great time there. The long story, is that I hardly ever took vacation because we were, you know, it literally was not necessarily a vacation all the time, but we had long days of breaks before in between flying. And so the chief pilot actually called me up and said, "Hey, Alan, you've got a lot of vacation on the books and they want you to take some vacation." So literally I said, "Well, how much do you want me to take?" He said, "We'd like to, you know, just get 3 weeks off the books." And I said, "Okay." So literally he said, "Okay, well, you're on vacation." I said, "Okay, cool." So literally without any notice, I said, "Well, I've always wanted to go to Alaska." So never been up there. So literally the next day I had a backpack. I was out at the airport trying to jump seat on Delta to Seattle and then get a jump seat on Alaska Airlines up to Anchorage, and made it to Seattle without any problem, but just about didn't get to Anchorage. But when I did get to Anchorage, sure enough, I got in late at night, got a hotel, and then found out a lot of different things to do. But there's a long, complicated story about how all this happened. But I wound up in Fairbanks via the Alaska Railroad. So when I got my ticket to go to Fairbanks on the railroad, they had a special where I could fly back to Anchorage for like $49. So I said, "Oh, that's a deal." So I got my airline ticket right there at the railroad, had it in my pocket. And when I got up there, it was Labor Day, which is the beginning of the tourist season.
Okay.
So when I went to the Fairbanks airport to fly back to Anchorage, I got to the ticket counter and they could not find my reservation. And I said, "But I've got a paper ticket. It's right here." And they went back and forth. Long story short, the girl in Anchorage, when she did my reservation, had made it for the right day, but it was for the following year.
Oh, man.
So I'm like, "Oh, man," because I was trying to get back to Anchorage to catch a Alaska jump seat to get back to Seattle to get on home, because I only had 2 days to get home before I actually had to be back at work.
Okay.
So I said, "Well, can you just get me a seat? Because I have a ticket." "Well, sir, this is Labor Day. Everything is oversold bad." So I'd already missed the Alaska Railroad to try to get back to Anchorage. So I'm going to just tell this part of the story just because it's hilarious. This is how I got on with Evergreen. Anyway, I had walked around the whole airport. I put my airline uniform on and tried to catch jump seats back to Anchorage. They were all full. And I had just about given up and I was walking out and I saw an Antonov, a Russian airplane, pull up to the gate at Fairbanks. And I was just like, and I saw passengers getting off of it. So I just decided to walk over to the gate agent. And I said, "You know, where's this airplane going? Are you bringing people in from Russia?" And she said, "Yeah, this is Russian tour groups." And she said, "Half of the airplane gets off here. The other half gets off in Anchorage." And I said, "Really? This airplane's going to Anchorage?" And she said, "Yeah, it leaves in about 30 minutes as soon as we could just get a little bit of catering on. And then it takes off and goes." And this was an old Antonov propeller airplane.
Right. Uh-huh.
So I said, "I know this sounds dumb, but is there any way I can get a jump seat? I'm desperate trying to get to Anchorage." "Oh, yeah, come on. We'll go talk to the pilot." So I go down there and talk to the pilots. And sure enough, they said, "Oh, yeah, you're more than welcome to ride up here with us. We'll give you a ride." So I was like, "Yes," but I've already missed my flights back to Seattle. So long story short, this is going down to Anchorage. We're rolling down the runway in this old Antonov, and I'm not joking, there's something that fell off the ceiling and landed in my lap. So I'm sitting here going, "Am I, you know, hopefully this was a good idea. You know, I'm just making sure nothing else is falling off on the outside of the airplane." But the funniest thing was that the pilots, there were three of them, they had an engineer and everything too, but the captain was just as big, huge, typical burly Russian guy that you always think of as Russians. And he had pretty good English. But we got into this conversation about how is it that I can travel between Fairbanks and Anchorage. He says, "Do you have papers?" And I said, "No, we don't have to have papers, you know." And then I told him I was trying to get back to the East Coast. And he was like, "What kind of papers do you have to travel?" And we got into how we were free to travel in the United States. And
right.
He got this big gruff look on his face and turned around and looked at me. And he said, "That is not fair. Tomorrow we declare war on America. Just talking to me like this. And I'm going, oh my gosh, here I am. I've never even been anywhere outside the United States and I'm fixing to cause an international incident, right? Then he looks at this first officer and turns around at me. And then he says, next day, we surrender. I'm just sitting there with sweat rolling down off my forehead, you know, thinking, what have I done? Anyway, that's the funniest part of that. I landed in Anchorage and I'd still had missed my ride back to Seattle, but there were these Evergreen, three 747s with Evergreen sitting there when we came in. They were on the ramp and they had just started coming into Atlanta. I had seen one of them come into Atlanta. And so I found their number in the phone book and I called and said, hey, where are your airplanes going? I'm a pilot with a little commuter airline in Atlanta. I said, I'm trying to get back home. He says, all three of them, one of them's going over to Korea, but two of them are heading to New York. And Atlantic Southeast Airlines had flights all the time into New York back to Atlanta. And I said, well, what's the chance that a little commuter pilot could get a ride on one of your airplanes in New York? He says, oh, you just come over here and talk to the crew. And he told me, he said, but they're both leaving in like an hour. And I said, okay, well, can I, where do I tell, I'm going to get a taxi and where do I tell them to go? He said, oh, are you at the terminal? He said, oh, we'll send a man over and pick you up. And I'm just like, this is not a normal jump seat procedure. Anyway, next thing I know, I'm in an Evergreen van and I went and I saw the crew that was going to New York, just talked to them. They said, oh yeah, come on out. And so that was my first time ever getting on a 747, rode with them to New York. And it turns out that the captain that was flying this flight was getting a check ride from the line check airman in the right seat. And there was a chief engineer in the engineer seat. Anyway, I talked to these guys all the way to New York and just said, what's the chances of a little turboprop guy ever getting on with a place like Evergreen? And all two of them gave me this number to call and said, fax your resume here. You don't probably understand the hiring procedure with airlines, but when you put in an application or fax a resume, if you're really lucky, you'll get any kind of response. If you're really fortunate, you'll hear something from them within 6 months. You know, okay. Anyway, when I got back, I had a day to get ready and then I had to go fly for ASA. So I did fax my resume up to this place. Anyway, I got back from a 3-day trip and there was a message on my phone from Evergreen to please call them. I'm like, wow, this is kind of weird. So anyway, I called them and they said, hey, is there any way you can get up here for an interview on Monday? And I was like, I'm just thinking to myself, are you serious? I said, this doesn't happen because I'd already tried to get on with like Delta and United. They wanted the 4-year degree. So I was off. So I said, yeah, sure. So I was fortunate enough and I got up there. They picked me up at Portland. I went down for an interview and I was sitting there in the office and I was interviewing with six other people. I mean, there was two C5A captains. There was a whole bunch of people from an airline that went out of business up here in Alaska that were 737 captains. And so I was feeling pretty puny, you know, being this little tiny turboprop guy, you know. So anyway, I was like the second guy back for the interview. And so when I came out, they told me to sit out and wait in the lobby. And so the next guy went in and he said, oh, okay, well, good luck. See you, and walk out the door. And then that the whole thing, everybody else that interviewed after me said, you know, the last guy actually said, oh, what are you still doing here? And I said, I don't know. They told me to sit here and wait. So the next thing I know, everybody was gone. The secretary said, hang on just a second, Alan, I got to just type up a few things and the chief pilot wants to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I go back and I sit down in front of the chief pilot and he says, okay, well, Alan, I understand you rode on a jump seat with us to New York here a week or so ago. And I said, oh yeah. I said, you flew with Tom and Chris. And I said, oh yeah, they're great people. You know, I had a blast learning about the 747. He says, yeah, well, they all put in a pretty good word for you. Can you be in 747 ground school next week? I just literally just melted in the chair. So I'm thinking I'm fixing to give up a 13-year career at ASA that's solid. I'm senior. I've got a good position. And I just said, yeah, sure. So I flew back to Atlanta, put in my, you know, resignation with Atlantic Southeast. And I told them I was really sorry that they just didn't give me much time, but there were no hard feelings there. And next thing I know, I'm sitting in the and a ground school for a 747. And then about 2 months later, I'm flying with the same captain that I flew with to New York that gave me the resignation, the recommendation. I'm sitting down at the Nairobi airport in Africa, flying a 747. So I did that for 17 years.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. So
that's Nairobi. That's Nairobi. Off the beaten path.
Quite, but it was fun. We did a lot of Africa flying, basically just flying vegetables and flowers and stuff. We brought them back to Nairobi, and then another crew took it up to Amsterdam, dropped everything off.
Crazy. That's crazy.
But 17 years with Evergreen doing all kinds of stuff. Was in Desert Storm, for the Department of Defense. And so, good career. And then unfortunately, the airline went out of business. So.
Yeah, that's too bad. I was reading about that. Yeah. Now, that was a 747. You call them classics. You keep on using the term classic.
Yeah.
What is a 747 classic versus a non-classic?
Okay. So the classic, the simulator that you flew, it basically had a bunch of round dials in the front.
Yeah.
No fancy TV screens.
Nope.
And it had the guy that was sitting behind your right shoulder that was the flight engineer. So you had another, mission control panel, the flight engineer runs. That's the classic. Aircraft wise, the only difference is that the newer version, which started off with the 747-400, it's only two pilots. There's no flight engineer, which in my opinion was a huge mistake. But and everything is glass. It you took away all of the round gauges, you took away all the flight engineer functions, and you let those duties be assumed by a computer. So whereas you only have two pilots on the newer airplane, the only real difference is the engines are more fuel efficient, and there's a whole lot less relays and the old fashioned black boxes down underneath the floor. It's now just all CPUs. So you've got basically six screens up front that the pilots use in lieu of all the round gauges and in lieu of all the switches, overhead, like you saw, they're actually, we've got to click this switch. And then, when we click that switch, look, that light comes on down there. Well, in the new one, you just basically push the button and it's like, all that stuff started. Okay, cool. That happened all automatically. There's no, most everything is automatic in the 747-400s. And then it went all the way up to the -8, which is like the last one that just took off out of Washington, to go to Atlas Airlines. That one is just, it's still not a whole lot different, except now you've got heads up displays like the modern airplane has. Right. So you can actually look straight out your windshield through a little display and see what's happening out in front of the airplane. And I think that airplane is like 30% more efficient than even the -400s. So with the newer engines. So.
Yeah. Okay. So after Evergreen, what happened?
When Evergreen went out of business, I started up, didn't really start up. I just kind of kicked into high gear an IT consulting company that I had run for several years with Evergreen as a standby, just in case something ever happened to my health and I lost my pilot's license or something happened to my airline. So I kicked that into high gear and was able to make a good living at it. Tried to grow and started running into the issue that I could not find anybody that wanted to work. And this was, this was even eight, nine years ago.
Right.
So I actually hired a couple of people. One of the persons that I hired was somebody that I knew, the son of somebody that I knew. He basically just disappeared, just decided he was going to go off on a vacation, which was okay, and just literally never came back. and then finally called me and said, I've met this girl,
it's sorry, always a girl.
Should have called you earlier, but I'm not going to come back to work. And then the next guy that I hired, super smart, picked everything up. I just thought he was going to be great. Spent several thousand dollars training him on the systems that we used for monitoring the networks and everything. And started noticing some decrease in performance. And unfortunately, it was a drug issue.
That's too bad.
Kid, basically, you know, I mean, 21 years old. And so anyway, I just said, you know, I've spent $20,000 training people that have gotten me nowhere. I'm talking to other IT people, and I attend a huge conference called IT Nation in Orlando every year. And so that's one of the biggest advantages of that is networking with other people that run businesses like I do to help manage other people's IT. And that was one of their biggest complaints. You know, there's plenty of people out there, but nobody wants to work.
So how did you get the skill set for IT? You didn't, it's established. You never got a degree, right?
Right.
So how did you get the skill set for running an IT business?
I was the geek in high school. This was back when, you know, literally there was no internet. But the high school had two computer terminals with the green screens, no color, no windows. It was all DOS. So I was actually writing programs in high school just for fun. We figured out how to connect to the school servers, you know, for the county at the time, which was dialing up a telephone number. Yes, on a rotary dial phone, slamming it down on the big two pieces of rubber and waiting for the fax tones to come through. And then finally saying, OK, it's connected.
Yeah.
And so and then I had a friend who was real connected with Georgia Tech. That was a friend of mine at high school. His dad was connected with Georgia Tech. So his dad got us usernames for the Georgia Tech cyber. So it was like every opportunity we got, we were blasting off to go down to Georgia Tech and programming with punch cards.
I'm with you. I'm with you 100%.
So, you know,
I was at SUNY Binghamton, and they used an IBM 370 program, learned how to program on punch cards. I don't even know how many rubber bands and boxes I used to protect these damn things, because the last thing you wanted to do is, like, you know, spill your deck, right?
Right.
Or watch it get shredded in the reader. And I became pretty darn good at JCL just to accelerate my jobs through the 370.
Neat.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's how I got into it. And then, you know, as I was doing things, I was keeping people's books. And a lot of that had to do with setting QuickBooks up and setting software up. So then the next thing I know, I was setting offices up on QuickBooks. And it's like, oh, well, how do we make this network together? So it was basically just all self-taught.
Very cool.
I got books, got hooked up with an IT service company in Anchorage that was real helpful. They were kind of like my partner, more or less. I could call them with any problems. And then I had the ability to pick up a fairly large accounting firm in Anchorage. And I went to this company, this other IT service company, which technically I would now be competition to them. And I said, I don't know anything about servers. And he said, oh, we got four good server guys, Alan. Just call us when you need some help. And we'll, and they actually sent somebody down to help me set up their server, and I'm competition to them. So that's how I got into it. And then I learned about servers. I learned about networking. I actually got to the point that Intuit, the QuickBooks company, was actually calling me, asking me how I made the networking work with the databases, because I had figured out a way to make the databases talk to each other, which Intuit would not do because they didn't like it done because of the way that their licensing worked.
Right.
But I had made it so that, you could run QuickBooks over here and run QuickBooks over here, and it would work. So I had to come up with a little SQL program to make sure that the databases didn't get corrupted. And so that's just how I grew into it. And then as I got more and more into it, going to things like IT Nation, which is basically a 5-day learning course, you know, you could take all kinds of classes, and I just self-educated myself.
Crazy. So. That's crazy. So let's fast forward a little bit more.
Yeah.
Sophia. Where the heck did that come from?
That came from old Evergreen contacts. There are three flight engineers actually at Sophia that flew with me at Evergreen. And one of them actually just called me up out of the blue and said, hey, Alan, these guys are looking for pilots. And I said, well, of course I'm interested. So about 2 years prior to me actually getting on with Sophia, I put in an application and was turned down because I did not have a college degree.
But an application for what? For Sophia?
For Sophia. Yeah. To fly Sophia.
Now you've been flying for like 30 years, 40 years, 100 years, all manner of vehicles, including Sophia. And they're hung up on a piece of paper.
They are. And it wasn't necessarily them. I mean, the people, you know, the whole people that were in the SOFIA program were like, yeah, this is stupid, but we can't do anything about it because we're federally government mandated for you to have a degree.
Yeah, but you're flying DOD missions into Kabul.
Yep. I didn't have a degree.
Okay, I'm trying to connect the dots here, but I guess government. I guess that's all we'll have to be able to say about that, government. So,
well, it's actually not, because I tried to get on with United and with Delta after I left Evergreen with 17,000 hours in a 747 flying international all over the place. Thank you for applying, but we do require a four-year degree. Thank you for applying, but we require a four-year degree. And those airlines, they would not touch me without a four-year degree.
That's insane.
I agree. And that's where the, you know, my whole thing with like what Mike Rowe says with the trade schools versus a college degree. A college degree would have not done anything to improve safety at any of these airlines. You know, and they're basically, you know, and I hear this all the time because I know a lot of pilots that don't have college degrees and they're like, Alan, where can we go? We've tried to get on everywhere like you have. And everybody's turning us down because they want a college degree, but they're turning down 15,000-20,000 hour pilots in favor of a 1,500 hour pilot just because he has a college degree.
Is that being fixed?
Not necessarily. Within the government, yes, because you know, under the, and I'm not doing anything political here, but one thing Donald Trump did do during his, you know, his time in the White House was he took away that requirement. And as soon as that was taken away, NASA called me and said, come to Denver. So literally, as soon as that requirement was lifted, all I had to do was literally reapply. They already knew who I was. They'd already looked at my resumes, already talked to me. And then I reapplied and they said, okay, yeah, when can you get to Denver? We need to get you current in the simulator. So That's crazy. You know, yeah. So my plan was actually to have been at NASA long before I actually was.
Yes, indeed. So, it took a long way.
It did. I took a long way, but fortunately, you know, the people were there. At, you know, and it's a good group. It's a good group. Is not a that's underscoring a lot, but it's a superbly excellent group of people to work with. They were doing everything, even when the college degree was required. There were people there that were trying to get that requirement dropped just for, you know, to get me on board.
Now, when you're sharing with me and the team was sharing with me what SOFIA was all about, okay, let's just, you know, spend a little bit of time on that, because I'll tell you what fascinated me. Was that, I forget which of you said that, you know, sometimes you only have like seconds for your target,
you
know, because the opportunity window is measured in seconds. And I'm thinking, you know, measured in seconds, you know, we have velocity, we have altitude, we have, I mean, all these different factors, you know, latitude and longitude, I mean, the where you are on the planet, right, and your orientation to the target that you're taking a picture of. And you have seconds to position the plane, or the opportunities lost. So
right,
why don't you share with us a little bit about what SOFIA was all about? I mean, I summed up some of the things that fascinated me when you're explaining it, but why don't you share with the audience and myself what SOFIA was all about?
So SOFIA, in the simplest terms, is a flying telescope. It's a Boeing 747 that has a 17-ton infrared telescope mounted in the rear of the aircraft. And we open up a huge door in flight. And no, there's no glass behind the door. It's actually opened up to air. An incredible design so that we, as pilots, don't even know that the door is open. But SOFIA stands for the Strategic Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. And what we do is with the telescope, we fly. I say we do. Everybody downstairs is what actually makes the magic on SOFIA. But we, the aircraft can actually look at things using light. And so it's actually looking at light that might be from 14,000 light years from Earth. They're actually looking at black holes, for instance. One of my missions was looking at a black hole that was 14,000 light years from Earth. And are they looking 14,000 light years away? No, but they're analyzing the intensity of a single pixel of light from that black hole and saying, well, based on the seven different angles this telescope just looked at that single pixel of light, we can determine that this light came from this far away, and then they run it through this huge algorithm, and then they take the millions of pixels that they look at over numerous missions, and they put together this incredible picture of a black hole that's 14,000 light years away. One of the achievements that actually helped save NASA billions of dollars was the SOFIA aircraft determined that Pluto had an atmosphere. They were sending the probe to go crash into Pluto, hoping to send data back for what was on the surface of the planet. Right. Well, had SOFIA not figured out that Pluto had an atmosphere, that probe would have burned up on reentry, and they would have never gotten any data back. So based on the data from SOFIA, they reprogrammed the probe to come in at a different angle and a different speed, and they actually hit the planet. So,
no, is Pluto a planet? Hold it. Is Pluto
a planet? Let's not get that. Let's not go there. I don't know.
Well, I mean, if it's yeah, big enough to have an atmosphere, you'd think, you know.
I still call it a planet. It was a planet when I was a little boy, so I call it a planet. So
yeah.
Yeah. But so SOFIA was just a big flying telescope, and it flew 4 to 5 nights every week, and just brought back a tremendous amount of data, you know, to the scientific community.
Right. So, and that was a joint op with Germany, right?
That's correct. Yeah, Germany had a huge science team on it. They were part of the development of the telescope. So yes, yeah.
Awesome. So yeah, and then the funding ended.
The funding ended prematurely. And that's about all I'm probably going to be able to say.
Right. It was but political. I did see that they took the aircraft to some museum. I mean, they didn't take it out to Arizona to have it mothballed. They actually flew it someplace. I forget where it was. I'll have to look it up. Yeah. For display.
Yeah, they did actually. It did actually go to Arizona, but it went to the Pima Air Museum, PINA.
Right.
And it is going to be on display, supposedly, where people can actually go up inside, you know, the airplane to see the actual telescope. You know, they took some parts off the airplane, but the telescope, since it couldn't be used anywhere else, remained basically intact.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's unfortunately, it had another 6 years under its projected life, you know, it's actually approved life cycle.
Right.
So I was hoping that airplane would take me to retirement, but it didn't. And sadly, I saw it, you know, saw the videos of it landing and being parked at the Pima Air Museum. So
what's next for you if you're not ready to retire yet?
No, I don't know. I'm not really sure. There's still an opportunity. There's the DC-8 that flies with NASA. I have been told that I'm basically first on the list to be called if there's a position that becomes open for that. But they're also replacing that airplane with a Boeing 777 or 777. So I don't really know. I'm probably going to kind of take a year off just to, you know, figure out if there is anything else that I want to do or if I do just want to retire. I'm working on an airplane project up here in Alaska for some old friends of mine to try to get a little more modern airplane on board to replace the DC-4 that they're working with now. There's all kinds of things that are possible. I don't really want to go back to the 747 cargo flying. That's a good possibility for me, but that's just not as fun as it used to be. And I'm hearing, you know, hear a lot of things about what's going on, you know, with the lack of experience, you know, because they're in such a dire need for pilots. They, you know, a lot of people would told me I would go crazy, you know, just trying to fly with some of these cargo operations when they've got literally guys that have got 1,000 hours sitting in the right seat of a 747. They said.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know that would be as fun as it was with Evergreen.
So I've been reading that some of these airlines are loosening up the requirements for getting a pilot's license and getting onboarded with them, almost like they have their own little university where they take you through the numbers. I don't know that the college degree requirement still exists, because I know there's a desperate need for pilots. At least that's what I read.
There is, and I know that United, I know for sure, has dropped the four-year degree requirement. I don't know about Delta. But yeah, there's like United is starting, you know, believe it or not, you know, you're in Germany, right?
Right.
So Lufthansa has got one of the best ideas that I have ever known of for getting pilots into their airline. They go into the high schools and they find out who wants to be a pilot in high school. They'll take those students, they interview them, they weed out the ones that that aren't serious, but the Lufthansa gets a good majority of their pilots when they're kids in high school, because Lufthansa puts them through their private pilot's license. They get them through their commercial licenses. Lufthansa trains them from ground zero to be a Lufthansa pilot. So Lufthansa will set them up as a flight instructor so they can get hours. And then Lufthansa moves them into their small airplanes with the airline, and they're fully trained.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that to me is like a fantastic way to get a good pilot, because then you don't have all the baggage, like say that I have, because I've been through a couple of airlines. I learned, you know, how to fly privately, corporately, with all these different procedures. So I had a lot of mental baggage in the way that, well, maybe this is the way that I would like to fly this big airplane.
Right.
But with Lufthansa, that mental baggage isn't there, because they, even in the small Cessnas, they're doing checklists just like they would do in a 747 with Lufthansa. Right. And right. So they've got these procedures down, and they're taught to be aviators. They're not taught to be computer programmers.
Right. So I don't want to hit on this too much unless you want to hit on it. But, you know, I'm in your camp, and I'm in Mike Rowe's camp, that, you know, having to have a college degree where there's no pragmatic reason to have one. It seems like it's starting to go the other way. It's finally moving that, you know, the trades are gaining respect again. I remember when I was graduating from high school, in front of my high school, it said 95%, and it was like, you know, bragging rights, 95% of our students or whatever it was are going on to college, as if the other 5% are losers. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, every 100% of our graduates graduated. That should be what the message is. And
should be. Yeah.
And some of them are going to learn to be plumbers, and some of them are going to go into the service, and some of them are going to go on to college. But we wish them all well and success and joy in their careers. Instead of having to have you know, a college degree for every stinking little thing. And, you know, I see this, I'm actually on the advisory board of a university in New York, and I have been for darn near 20 years. If not, I should get a clock or something, I think, this year. but, you know, I'm attached to the system science and industrial engineering department. And so there happens to be a lot of common sense in industrial engineering. But, you know, it bothers me, all the electives, all the non-core subjects that they, you know, that they have to take. Yeah. You could learn everything you need to learn in order to be proficient in 2 years' time at a four-year school if you didn't have to take non-core classes that, you know, and pay for those non-core classes.
Right.
And I just don't understand it. And, anyway, I know that's a passion of yours, you know, trade schools and, you know, the value that they can add to society. And that, you know, I even know a couple that make $250,000 a year as crane operators. You know, they just work in New York City as crane operators. I have a cousin. He makes a ridiculous amount of money changing light bulbs on the top of those towers, you know, like the cell phone towers and stuff like that. And he's got pictures of, like, you know, New York City skyline from the top of one of these towers. It's just like neat. Crazy.
Yeah.
So.
No, I'm in the same boat. You know, I mean, even when I went to college, you know, back in the early 1980s, I was so disappointed when I got to college because I was like rehashing my courses for the first year were set up to be like my 10th and 11th grade high school courses.
Yeah.
Why? I'm ready to go to aeronautical engineering, man. I want to get at least a drafting course in here somewhere. I couldn't even take an elective for drafting. I had to rehash everything I did in high school. And that's one of the reasons I kind of left college, because my mom and dad were paying for my college, you know, so that's a privilege to begin with. But I was like, you know, I'm not going to waste my mom and dad's money rehashing everything that I just did in high school in hopes that when I get to my third year, I can actually get into something that takes me into aeronautical engineering.
Yeah.
So my mom and dad, I mean, they saw that and like they took a lot of my college money and let me use that to get my pilot rating.
That's awesome.
So, you know, that was a blessing. But to me, if somebody wanted to be a pilot, the first thing you do out of high school is you go find you one of these flight schools that are tied in with the airlines, and you go and you take the money that you would have spent on college and you go get your private pilot's license, which most of the guys would already have. But you go upgrade your licenses and you become a flight instructor with these schools that you're going to. They'll let you teach their students. So you build your hours, get to that magic 1500 hour mark that the airlines are wanting. And then they've already got agreements with the airlines. So then when the airlines get somebody from this school, they've already been flying for 3 or 4 years.
Right.
They're trained in your procedures, similar to what Lufthansa does. And you get a qualified pilot that's been a flight instructor. So he's had, you know, something weird happened where he's like, okay, he's had to actually aviate, not just depend on a piece of computer technology to say, oh, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And And so in lieu of them coming out of, okay, so Delta says, oh, this guy's got a 4-year degree and he was a pilot in the military. Okay, cool. So you get an F-18 driver that goes over to one of the major airlines. Nothing wrong with F-18 drivers. They're awesome. But he's got a 4-year degree and he's flown F-18s. So the only thing that's going to give Delta is hard landings.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I could always tell what service the pilot served in by the way they land.
You know, that's right.
The Marines and the Navy aviators, they slam it on the deck. You know, and the Air Force guys sort of glided on in. And it's just pretty funny.
But that's, you know, that's the whole thing is, even if you do that, you know, Delta still has to train that pilot how to fly a commercial airliner. But they don't have to necessarily train the guy that came out of the flight school.
Yeah. What I've been reading is that some of these airlines are basically acting as the education loan agents for these young pilots, where they're basically holding the note, and as the pilots graduate and work for the airline, they sort of earn it off.
Right. United, I know, is doing that. I'm not sure about other airlines, but I have read that United has started that.
Well, listen, Alan, you know, I got to tell you, thank you very much for taking the time and being with me today. And I'm sure the audience is going to enjoy this interview a great deal. You've been an outstanding guest and very, very much enjoyed the conversation.
Well, same here. And like I say, it was real nice meeting you back in Denver, you know, last year, and getting to take you around and give you just a little peek of what we get to do. And enjoyed knowing you all this time. I still follow you closely on LinkedIn. So, you know, and definitely enjoyed it. I wasn't sure how good I would be at something like this, but you made it simple. So thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, have a great rest of your day there, Alan.
Okay. You too, Joe. Enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.